Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Michael Harding, you're very welcome. How are you?
I'm very good.
Michael, you've written a lovely new book called Midwinter, and it's partly your own meditations on the season, and then there's threaded in there the story of a young man.
Yeah.
You know what my first thought after I put the book down was?
What?
I thought it's good to be alive.
Absolutely. I think that's the whole point about the book.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, in a way, it's kind of, for me, it's a Buddhist practice that you don't choose all the good things in your life and hold on to them and think you won't ever have to suffer anything. And it's the same with summer versus winter. People love summer. I love summer. I could tell you memories of like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock of a summer's morning with the dregs of a bottle of wine down at the lake shore with the loved one, do you know?
Yeah.
We all have those beautiful moments, but they pass and we grow old and then it goes to winter. And you can have this thing, like my mother had it in her old age. It was awful, you know. You'd hear her saying, oh, I dread the winter.
So?
I dread the winter, right?
Literally 2 days after I read the book and thought it's good to be alive, right?
Yeah.
And I can time it. It was Wednesday morning. I woke up and looked out at the dark and thought, I can't do another one. I can't do another one of these.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I suppose your point is that we kind of have to... And then I thought, is it my resistance to the winter that is causing me the issue here? Like, you're kind of saying accept, embrace, yeah?
I think so. And the first lesson I got 35 years ago from... A Tibetan Buddhist teacher, when I went in and I was expecting very profound teachings, right?
Yeah.
And she brought me into the kitchen and I said to her, like, if I'm going to join up here and be Buddhist, like, what do I get? What's the basic thing that's interesting? And she said, do you like mustard on sausages? And I said, no, I can't stand them. And she said, well, that's the whole point. Someday you'll realise the mustard doesn't matter. What you like, tomorrow you could love it. And I went home and I practised by putting mustard on the sausage. And I said to myself, that's kind of nice. And I changed my view about that little trivial thing. And in Buddhism I've learned that you change your perceptions. You detach yourself from all the things that you believe. And you realise... You may be wrong about everything, but there's something deeper inside you which is in the present moment and it's engaging with the world around you. And that's what's beautiful.
And hang on, are you saying you can actually choose what you like?
Yeah.
I can decide.
Something you think
you dislike, you can choose to like it.
I'm not an enlightened human being, but
that's what
the old Buddhists are saying. You know? But I mean, like, I haven't sat for 6 months in the snow with my legs crossed with no clothes on, you know, up in Tibet. But that's basically the idea. And it has helped me. Like, I've got rid at times of anger, at times where I would have a negative view of somebody. Could be somebody in the family. It could be somebody that it's like I have a habit of saying I can't stand that fella.
Yeah.
Right. And like Buddhist practice is to say that's only a perception. It's not the deepest you. And the deepest you is just kind of in love with everything around you, including that fella. And this is where I come to winter, that I would say, like everybody else, I dread winter. And because I went through a bit of depression, a good bit of it, 2011, 2012, 2013, I came to really experience what it is to dread winter. And then I still do a podcast, but sometimes I would say, hello, it's Michael Harding. Well, it's a wet day in November. Now, if you're going to do a podcast and you start off saying, well, it's a wet day here in Leitrim and it's miserable.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to have anybody listening.
Yeah.
So I used to kind of say, it's a beautiful day and the rain is lovely. The rain is falling now on the trees. And I was walking in, by the way, to the studio this morning and all the chestnut trees are gone rusty and all the beech trees are gone amber. And they're so beautiful. And everything about winter is beautiful. And the rain in Leitrim is beautiful. If you just stop having this baggage of what I love and what I hate, and just be there in that present moment. Marilyn Robinson, the American, great American novelist, she says, just pay attention. If you pay attention, you'll find your bliss. And I think I have found that so much in the winter in the past 5 or 6 years that I really had to write the book about it.
Okay. You know, so just look at it like even you, even the decay
yeah.
of winter you talk about in a beautiful way.
Yeah, it's exquisite. It's exquisite. Like recently, like yesterday morning, I'm passing an old rotten tree, which is outside our gate, and there's this fungus growing on it. And you would say, oh, that's a disgusting fungus. You know, big old yellow mushroom all clustered together at the root of a rotten tree. And then I go up and I kind of research it, and I find that's what they call a honey mushroom. It's a sweet mushroom that adds enormously to your diet, you know, that everything we have perceptions of as negative could be beautiful. And most importantly, I think the people that we think are wrong, the people we think have bad ideas, the people we think are the enemy,
yeah,
they're as beautiful as we are. They're as loving as we are. They're as compassionate to their cat and their pets and their children. There's no enemies. And that's what you get. If you start practicing this stuff about winter, it's like realizing that winter is a metaphor for your own life. You're going to get old. I'm 72, and when I started writing, for example, columns about Mullingar, I'd be going into shops, gala shops, looking for beautiful Polish women and romanticising about how I'd have a great life with them, right? Yeah. That was a kind of a young boyish narrative. But at 72, what have I left but the narrative of an old man, which is the wisdom to say everything is impermanent, everything passes. Your youth will pass, your childhood will pass, everything, even the pain will pass, even depression, it will all pass. And so that sense of just letting go of all these attachments, and we get attached to negative things, we get attached to anger, and we get attached to, you know, hostility towards certain people. And you can liberate you from it. And one of the ways I do it, I'm not saying that anybody would do this, I'm only telling my story.
Yeah.
And my story in the past 4 or 5 winters has been an exquisite meditation just on the utter beauty of this darkness as it enfolds us. You know, it's like the end of life. And the mystery is, it enfolds us towards the 22nd of December, but your eye is on St. Bridget's Day. It's the mystery that even in death, don't be afraid. It will come light again. It will come beautiful again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. For most people make it through.
Yeah.
There's a text here, and actually, I think it could be a Buddhist master. He says,
I'm in trouble.
Mustard on sausages can be lovely.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah,
it can be.
Yeah.
Okay, even if you don't like it, it can be. Get yourself in the right. Yeah, so the death thing is throughout, in the sense that I was thinking, reading it, of that. You know that French phrase, le petit mort, which I think they mean the feeling post an orgasm, but the little death.
Yeah.
That basically, winter, you think even ourselves, like that we kind of, it is like a little death for us, and then we come back to life.
That's exactly, I think, what it is. And I think when you are afraid of winter, when you dread winter, you're not looking at the end of it. The end of it is the transformation. The transformation from the solstice, this amazing time. You know, we're getting further and further away from the sun. It's like a stone that has been thrown away. And at a certain point, gravity brings us back again. And the whole thing renews itself. And I do think that is a metaphor. I feel that in every stage of my life. You know, 10 years ago, I was anxious because I felt my, let's say, late middle age was falling apart. And I'd be stressed. And I would think that, like, people don't take me as serious as they did when I was 40. Or I don't feel as strong, or I don't look as well if I go to a gym. And gradually then you get to 70 and you let go of everything because you have to. And you suddenly find the comedy and the grace of saying, this is a new phase in my life. So every phase leads to another phase. And I would believe that winter coming into spring must be a metaphor for what happens at the end of life.
Do you think?
Personally.
Yeah.
There's one beautiful image. I don't know who gave this image, some great scholar, but you know, the caterpillar becomes the butterfly. and there is no evidence in the caterpillar what would happen afterwards. And yet the transformation is astonishing.
Okay. And so the caterpillar hasn't a clue that good times are ahead.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Or maybe it does.
Do we have to trust, like...
Or maybe it does.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have to ask the caterpillar that.
Yes, yes. You're a fan in the winter of the kind of meditative doze.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know the way, and I'm guilty of this myself, like I try psychotherapy. I do everything and everything helps. And I do say, if any therapy helps you get through the day, use it, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's also a bit when we're trying to be well, that we try to be well with our fists clenched.
Yes.
Right? We make a fierce effort.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember there was one moment it came to me. I was up at the top of Skellig, Michael, and it's a beautiful place up there at the top of the rock. And there was a woman inside in one of the beehive huts, beautiful beehive huts. And she's doing it perfectly. Her back is straight. She's in a lotus position. She's the hands joined, in front of her. She's in a meditative Buddhist position. And she had a little flickering light, a candle in front of her. It was absolutely beautiful. She was doing it perfect, right? Now, I couldn't resist because it's an OPW site and you're not supposed to light anything inside in them beehives. Yeah. So for divilment, I couldn't resist saying to her, and she was far away in Samadhi land, peace. And I said, excuse me, you're not supposed to light anything in here. Well, she kind of wheeled around. She swiveled in her meditational pose, looked at me in an instant and said in a hiss, would you ever fuck off? And I thought, she's doing it well, right? And we do this thing, we clench our fists to try and say, I'm feeling great today. I met one fella, by the way, this is another. I met this fella, he's an Indian, and I met him in Ireland, but he's a beautiful, elegant statement. If you're meditating, and you're meditating well, maybe half an hour every morning, you're doing very well. One thing certain is you're not meditating. because it's the problem that if you name the bird, you cease to experience the song. We name it.
Yeah.
We grasp it. And there's a great thing in the Heart Sutra that says the ultimate teaching is there's no teaching. You must let go of everything.
But if you're trying to let go, then you can't let go.
Okay, follow. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, what's the answer like? The to answer, try to stop is trying.
I would say that you know and I know that there's a place beyond the rules that you let go and it happens through you. It can happen when you're doing an interview with somebody and it comes to a flow that you've broken all the rules, but it's happening perfectly.
So the song is singing you.
Exactly, exactly. Basho, the great Zen fella, he said, learn the rules, but then forget the rules.
Yeah.
And E.M. Foster said, if you want to be a good writer, it's like playing tennis without the net. And like in every discipline, you'll get this wisdom from people that says, there's an inner you that is in harmony with everything around you.
But it's very hard to get yourself out of the way, isn't it?
Absolutely. But if you don't, you end up being the pious, religious, neurotic person who says, I'm wonderful.
And have you got yourself out of the way a bit?
No.
But we keep striving by not striving, correct?
Absolutely. And my achievement, just let me say this, to be honest, and I really know this at 72, I know that my wisdom has been that I know nothing.
Yeah.
And when I say that to sometimes to people, they say, now come on, you do. But I don't. And that, in a sense, that is the mystery, that you can let go even of your insecurities of how little you know. I know nothing, but I'm here. And I know that being here, like Thich Nhat Hanh had said, be here now. I know that that's the source of joy in me.
Be present.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, the feast days and the rituals and that helped with the winter too, yeah?
They help with the winter and Christmas helps. I personally love being on my own. I have a little room at the back, shed in the backyard, and I would have I'm a Christian, so I put up an icon, I put up a little candle in front of it on a dark evening, 4 o'clock. I could sit there with a bit of a fire or Rachmaninoff playing on the machine. I could sit there for an hour in complete joy and feel that all the darkness outside falling, enveloping the trees, is beautiful. But for other people, it'll be a different thing. But, like, even though I love that, I also, and I say this in the book, and I have fun with this in the book, like, Christmas is a nightmare.
No, you're down on Christmas.
Yeah.
A month of the tyranny of enforced
Absolutely.
Glee.
Yeah. It's crazy in a sense. I can understand how it will wither as a feast. Because if the heart is not in it and it's not about... I say at one stage of people who are gathering around the crib they no longer believe in, that if you go to the church in a way that's the core of your Christmas... And I don't do it even every year. I remember doing it in Drumshambo, I think it was last Christmas, 12 months. And it was utterly exquisite. Like, I came out of it walking on air in the middle of the night, right? Even though I don't go to Mass regularly. But if you put the Christian thing or the Buddhist thing or the Islamic thing, your faith, is if it's at the centre, you'll have joy, I think. But if you were just doing Christmas and it becomes that terrible burden that I've gone through, you've gone through, what will we do with Auntie Molly? Is she coming on the Tuesday or the Wednesday and blah, 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 and all the things you have to organise. And it's like the young people come and you see them eating the turkey, dying to get out the door, right?
Yeah.
So all that stress of Christmas and the money that it costs to do Christmas. But
we're back to the sausage with the mustard. People will say they have no choice.
They have no choice in that.
Do we have choice in it?
No, I don't think people have... Like, yeah, if you're stuck for money, you don't have choice.
Yeah.
That's a terrible place to be.
And if you're stuck with family obligations,
if you're depressed, there's no choice. It's what you're suffering and enduring. I'm not saying that you have a freedom, that Buddhism gives you that kind of freedom. But Buddhism does give you freedom to practice ways of calmness that help those difficult moments. Right, you still have no money for Christmas. You're still poor at the table. You're still struggling, or you go into debt, or whatever. But in some way, if you practice in some way from the inner space of your heart, I think it helps you get through the day.
Okay,
that's all I'd ever.
So try and get down underneath again, and underneath the head, and something more. Yeah,
a lovely woman that talked about it, by the way, was Julian of Norwich. Right. She's famous for using that phrase, all will be well and all manner of things will be well. Now, she was a hermit. She lived like locked in a room and she had a little window and she talked to loads of pilgrims who would come to see her. But she also previously, they say or they presume, had a husband and children, all of which died during the Black Death. She was a woman who suffered terribly, right? But she ended up sharing this one single thing with everybody. All will be well, no matter how dark it is. And there's one thing I've held on to this for decades. Per tenebras ad lucem. Even when you're really in the complete darkness of, let's say, loneliness or depression, there's some way if you penetrate it, if you pay attention, just be there with it.
Yeah.
I think, in my experience, I found a light in that shadow. There's something mysterious even about the dark winter, that the whispering voice of the cosmos is saying, this is just part of your journey and your suffering, but all will be well.
Okay, so don't run away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a story on that note, the story I alluded to, that is threaded throughout the book about the death of a young man, Martin. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, Martin is a fiction in the book, the story of a young man who dies by his own hand. And it's not so much the story of him, because I never go inside him, but it's the story of the loss that's left for everybody afterwards. The terrible loss of losing anybody, losing your mother, losing your sibling, but losing a child. And then the unspeakable loss of losing a child who has done by their own hand the action and leaves everybody confused, no matter how much they loved him or her. But all my life, from I was in secondary school, I could name out the litany of lovely, beautiful guys I was at school with. Maybe three, I think, in secondary school alone, who took their own life. And through life then you have other people who fall victim of that. And then eventually, as you get older, you find your friends whose children have fallen victim to it. And so I was probably, for some reason, triggered last winter. I was writing the book about winter, and it was like, you can't write about death. You know, in foxes and badgers and trees and like winter is death, and ignore that our human frailty is in there as well. And so for some reason, and I would say numerous, maybe two or three very, very personal experiences, I felt this is a moment to just share the loss that people have when somebody goes in that way. And to try and say that there is something in the dynamic of love for somebody, that even if they do lose their life in circumstances like that, there's something unnameable comes afterwards. There's some, the pain may never go, but the sense of hope is still, it's like the metaphor, is like spring in St. Bridget's Day. Life goes on again. You know, it's unspeakable. It's very hard to write about. And
one of the things that's interesting about it is you focus more on his mother and his young girlfriend.
Yeah.
And how much they loved him and are devastated by his passing.
Yeah.
And kind of, I suppose, the unspoken question of, did he know that? Did he have any idea?
It's impossible. No, we can never know. And, you know, there was a young woman close to our family, and she would visit us. She was a funny, vivacious woman in her 20s with, you know, the job she loved. And she passed away in those circumstances. And nobody can ever know, and her parents could never know. And last winter, I had a close friend who was going through that process of having lost his son. And I think probably that triggered me to say, if I could enfold the story of that sort of tragedy in the idea of winter, that, you know, winter is like our own death. Winter is death, and it comes, but there is a spring. There is a new beginning. But no matter how we can't understand it, I honestly have to say that.
The book is less, what would I say, less kind of like stories than some of your other books. It's a bit different. Is it back to what you said there about, like, we can't understand it? Like, are you getting into a space where you're not strictly operating in the realm of rational stuff anymore with the writing? Yeah, you've gone beyond this to a point of more about faith?
I think it's a meditation. So it's not an affirmation of my own faith or anything. There's no Christian or Buddhist ostensible ideas in it as a story. It's simply a kind of a abiding with the darkness of winter and a sense that this too is beautiful, and at the core of it is the hope of transformation, that even this winter, this time of winter, carries a sort of a hidden light that emerges then again in the springtime. It's gone away from us, but it will come back to us. That kind of feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that...
I suppose what I'm saying is...
I finished Memoirs. Back to the
understanding business, though. Is it that we have to stop trying to make sense of everything and get the meaning of everything and deconstructing everything?
I would love to just
go with it, like.
I would love if I could write a book like that. And I think there's a great Chinese book, Soul Mountain, and there's a great fella. He wrote a book called Essays on Idleness, and it's like, as an older person, you stop writing memoirs. I'm finished. I did 8-9 memoirs.
Yeah,
and I did novels. I did plays. But all sorts of stuff. But my time in life now is to begin just meditating and sharing how I bear witness to simply the impermanence of everything. Everything passes, but don't be afraid. It's okay, because we're here.
Can I ask you a really basic question? You alluded there to your own big depression in the early 2010s. In a way, like, I think it was that brought you to my attention, kind of the depression that made you famous in a way.
Yeah.
How did you get out of it?
a particular therapist who was superb for, we'll say, 3 years and 3 winters. I did sessions.
Yeah.
Right. So the one, a session was like a season of about, say, 12 weeks. And then I did that on for 3 years. And then after that, I felt, you know, I've covered a lot of what was, you know, whatever was doing me psychological damage from childhood or all the rest of it. And I still felt I don't have a joy, right? And that's when I wrote a book called On Tuesdays I'm a Buddhist, precisely there about 2015. And it was like I realised for about the 10th time in my life, having given up religion, walked away from religion, I've enough of that. And then I realised again, God, I need it. I need it not for any big meaning, but for the practice of something that gives me a little quiet joy. It's like I can live life poetically. I think that if you kill religious language, you've lost poetry. Because it's the essential metaphor. Like when you say we are here, we are loved. When you say we are enfolded in the trees and it's God's fingerprint, you're talking poetry. And I think that I did it about 2016 in a very personal choice because somebody accidentally gave me an icon. Now, I wasn't doing anything Christian at the time. I was doing Buddhist stuff. But like somebody gave me an icon of the Mother of God. And I said to myself, like, that's like giving a bottle of vodka to a reformed alcoholic.
Yeah.
Right? Because I wasn't going to stick the icon on the wall as an art object. So I put a little flame in front of it in my room. And then I'd start talking to it.
And it got your head over your backside, did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't get everything out of the backside.
Yeah. Come here. Do you think that a lot of Irish people finding an affinity with Buddhism? Is it because we're lapsed Catholics, or is there something in it that it speaks to us?
I think there's something bigger. I mean, for us in Ireland, the collapse of institutional Christian institutions, that's nearly done now. But that's been happening in Europe for 200 years. So it wasn't a surprise when the institutions were collapsing in Ireland. The thing of Christian or Buddhism is like a bigger wave, right? And a slower wave. And it's interesting what the Dalai Lama says about this. He says that Westerners shouldn't become Buddhists. You shouldn't be trying to be a Buddhist. He would say, we've enough of Buddhists in the world and we don't want any more. Be a good Christian. So being a good Christian is a way to be a Buddhist. Because the minute you start differentiating and saying, well, I'm finished with Christianity, so I start Buddhism, that differentiation is anathema to the whole idea of Buddhism, which is simply to be where you are and rejoice in being present in the now. So the Dalai Lama would say we need more Christians, better Christians. But if that's not going to happen, I think, you know, the Silk Road. The Silk Road was a commerce road for 3,000 years. But it has also been a road of ideas. And it was inevitable and has been gradual that there's just been beautiful ideas of, if you like, psychotherapy in the East. And we never copped on to them until we began psychotherapy in the West, which was probably only about 200 years ago. And again, somebody asked the Dalai Lama, what did he think of Western psychotherapy? And he said, it's very good. He said, but it's in its infancy. Meaning, like, we've been doing mind training for 600 years. You know, the texts that I would personally be using by Shantideva, another, like, our ancient Tibetan boys, like, they were written 700 years ago about how to train the mind and how to get the mind to be less engaged or less attached to negative emotions.
Okay. So I would think this conversation is pretty impactful. I would think there are a lot of people thinking, okay, I would like to try and get into what he's talking about there.
Yeah.
What is the first step?
Well, don't think I've been evasive now.
The way that can be spoken is not the way. Go on.
Major crossroads in the conversation. I am not a teacher, a Buddhist, a Christian. I'm not like a teacher of those things. And I'm not a psychologist or a therapist. You know, talk to Ian Robertson or talk to Tony Bates. They're great guys. They know what's going on. I don't, and I genuinely don't, and I'm not being faux about I'm just a storyteller. All I know is that even in my simplicity, even coming from the past class, even coming from mediocrity, if I share my story, it might be interesting to somebody. And that's essentially always what I've been doing and still I'm doing.
You wouldn't give them a first step. Give them something they could do, a bit of meditation or something or something.
I'd say just be here now, just wherever you are, pay attention. Take 5 minutes in the day and be present.
So you're in a different phase life as a writer and everything, yeah?
I'd hope so, yeah.
What's next now?
I don't know. I might start a column somewhere.
Do you know what was a great, joyous relief at the end of the book is the spring came.
Yeah.
And you got out of your room and headed off out again.
That's right.
Took on the road, meeting the people.
Well, come here to me.
Was, yeah.
Brendan, I'm in Ballybofey tonight on that journey. So hello, Ballybofey.
I knew you were saving the tips for a paying audience. He's not giving it away for free here now.
I love that moment where you leave. You know, one part of you wants to be within the room in your own heart. That's where we need to be.
Yeah.
We need to find places that a place of shelter, that you're it's not that you go into the wood, you go into the wood that's in your heart. You go into the room that's in your heart, and that's where you wake. Now when you've done that, the impulse should be to go out and just find, you know, all the people that you want to forgive and apologize to and share with and dance with and be joyful. The kind of connection of compassion.
Yeah.
Is the other side of...
Okay, and it's okay if it ebbs and flows.
I think you need both.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Listen, loads of text, but basically all saying you're fantastic and all that. But I will leave us with Eileen in Kerry, who quotes Albert Camus, "In the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer."
Yeah.
Michael Harding, thank you so much. The book is called Midwinter, A Journey Through a Season, and it's out now, published by Hachette. And if you've been affected by any of the issues raised during this conversation, you'll find a range of resources at rte.ie/helplines. Thank you so much, Michael. I'm off to lie down in a dark room and try and absorb all of that. I might go on to rte.ie/helplines. Michael Harding, thank you.